pronounces us as followers of Jesus Christ crazy. And they will. Smile. And keep speaking the truth.
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
Good morning. You know, I have more than once or twice had people roll their eyes at me and insist that I was crazy. Sometimes it concerned the things that I am willing to eat. Sometimes it concerned the things that I am willing to do. But more than once, people have insisted that I am crazy. I tell you, it's getting easier to provoke that reaction all the time in these days of polarization in our society where the disagreements are so profound and stark. The activist atheists insist that belief in God is a form of mental illness, and so by simple definition, all of us are crazy. And these days, I have read articles on both sides of the political spectrum, the right and the left, where it is an effort made to define the opposing point of view as a mental illness. Liberals think that conservatives don't just disagree with them, they are mentally ill, elsewise they wouldn't have all these strange ideas. And some conservatives think the same things about liberals. And so it goes. The field of psychology is currently struggling with their definition that has been in force for a couple of decades now, called personality disorder, by which they largely assess mental health. The problem is that by the existing definitions of personality disorder, everybody is crazy. Everybody. The definitions are built on an idealized notion of an ideal personality that doesn't really exist in any actual human being, and so compared to it, everyone is crazy. They're struggling to remedy that diagnostic problem. But maybe they have something. As you noted in our core doctrine points for the month, I believe all men are sinners. Every last one of us. We cannot rise by any efforts of our own to a state of perfect purity and righteousness. Perhaps that means that we cannot rise by any efforts of our own to anything that really, truly resembles mental health either. But however you may feel about that, I provoked people to call me crazy back in the days when it was harder. I'm just saying. The saga of the Apostle Paul's imprisonment and his pending trial continues in Acts chapter 26. In the course of this chapter, Paul will be pronounced crazy by the governor Festus, as Bill read for us this morning. But let's start with the governor Festus. You can't tell the players without a program. If you were here last week, you already know a little bit about Festus. He was the new Roman governor that replaced Felix from the previous chapters. Where Pilate had been a soldier and Felix was a political deal maker, Festus was a human resources, people-oriented administrator. Festus had been charged by his superiors with finding out just exactly how far the Jewish people could be integrated into what was called Roman civic privilege, the ability to instigate and press legal actions in the Roman system. This was a new and difficult thing to try to accomplish with the Jews who had previously been completely barred from civic privilege. But it was Festus's job to figure it out. Early in his brief administration, because Festus was the governor for only 3 years before he died of an unnamed illness, early in his administration, he thought that he had found the perfect test case in the matter concerning the Apostle Paul. The Jewish leadership had charges they wished to prefer against a Roman citizen who also happened to be a Jew, custom made for Festus's assignment, but the details of the case proved baffling to him. The disagreement between the Jewish leadership and Paul seemed to be a religious doctrinal kind of thing that he couldn't quite wrap his mind around, and there was no crime in the Roman sense that he could put his finger on of which they were accusing Paul. Now, I will assume that we already have a pretty good grip on the Apostle Paul, so I'll move on to Herod Agrippa II, who is the Herod of this chapter. Sometime ago, when we looked at Acts chapter 12, I showed you a chart of the dynastic house of the Herods. It started with Herod the Great. That's the one that murdered the babies of Bethlehem in his effort to prevent the arrival of Christ in the very beginning. Herod the Great had five wives, two of which were named Mariamne. By his five wives, Herod the Great had seven sons, most of whom he either had executed or banished in order to prevent what probably imagined attempts at a coup in his paranoid mind. But one of those sons, born to Mariamne the Asmonean, as opposed to Mariamne the Bothusian, was Herod Aristobulus, who before his untimely death executed by his father, had three children of his own, including Herod Agrippa I, and that is the man who in Acts 12 had executed the Apostle James, tried to execute the Apostle Peter, and was eaten of worms, all in Acts 12. Before that death, Herod Agrippa I had three children. One, we have already met in a previous chapter, Drusilla, the ugly sister, who left her husband Azizus to marry the former governor Felix. In their time together, Felix and Drusilla had one child, Herod Agrippa III. When Felix was exiled, Drusilla took the boy and fled for greener pastures. At least she thought so. You know that story of the guy that survived the bombing of Hiroshima and moved in with relatives in Nagasaki? I think everybody in the 8 o'clock service knows the import of the two cities. Drusilla fled to Pompeii with her son, where in the year AD 79, she, Herod Agrippa III, and almost the entire population of Pompeii and the neighboring Herculaneum perished in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. At that moment, young Herod Agrippa III became the final end of the house of Herod. But backing up that decade and a half or so, we meet the two other children of Herod Agrippa I, Herod Agrippa II, and Bernice. Now, in case you didn't catch that, that made Felix, the former governor, the brother-in-law of Herod Agrippa II and Bernice, and that makes Herod Agrippa II and Bernice, who appear in the present chapter, not husband and wife, but brother and sister. They were living in the same household at the time. There were rumors about their behavior, but those were never confirmed and probably were just rumors. But they were brother and sister. And Bernice was the pretty sister. She does not materially contribute to the story, but I will give you a little bit about her as background. The Romans considered her as one of those exotic Eastern princesses to whom everyone wanted to be married, and in Bernice's case, to whom almost everyone was married, at least for a little while. In modern terms, think of Zsa Zsa Gabor, Hungarian beauty queen, model, and actress who was married 9 times and who had lots of other relationships in between the formal marriages. Bernice beat out Zsa Zsa in the number of marriages, and in the brevity of each, marrying and divorcing a series of 11 important Roman citizens, all of whom were attracted to her exotic beauty and the benefits of an alliance with a wealthy and important family who, although Jewish, had solid political connections with Rome. At this point in her life, Bernice spends a few years unmarried, lived with her brother, Herod Agrippa II. In just a few years, she will marry the famous Roman general Titus, which means that in AD 70, it will be Bernice's husband who wipes out Bernice's hometown. And Bernice will weep, but she will stay with her husband until he becomes emperor, at which point he will divorce her and shove her aside and marry some girl who had a blue blood Roman heritage. At that point, Bernice falls out of the record and we are unfamiliar with the details of her death. All that said, the big point about the Herods is that they were a Jewish family who, because of the military services of Herod the Great long ago, had established this relationship with Rome, had solid connections. Each generation of the dynasty of Herod worked hard to maintain their relationship with Rome, also to maintain their good graces and connections with the Jewish community. They made big financial contributions to important Jewish projects. They funded the beautification and upgrading of noted Jewish facilities. They gave big amounts to established Jewish charities. They supported rabbis financially so that they could continue their teaching. They did all these things and others, including occasionally seeking political favors from Rome for some, at least, of the prominent Jewish citizens. They did all these things because they understood that their chief value to Rome was their connection to the Jewish community. They understood all things Jewish, and they could get into Jewish society in a way that most Roman political people could not, and so they were valuable Rome. And that's what's going on here. Faced with the undying antagonism of the Jews, Festus's lack of understanding of his case, and worn out by going on now 3 solid years of imprisonment and legal wrangling, Paul has appealed to Caesar. And Festus must send him to Rome to be judged by Caesar. But there's another thing Festus must do, not mentioned specifically here in this chapter, but he was required by Roman law to send along with Paul a detailed account of the charges that have been made, of their importance, and of everything that has been done and heard on the case so far. And Festus has absolutely no idea what to write or how to categorize Paul's case. So by having Herod Agrippa and Bernice, acknowledged Roman experts on all things Jewish, sit in on this interview, Festus may finally be able to gain an understanding of what is going on so that he can make his report. So the interview opens, and the Apostle Paul stands before a Roman governor, a Jewish king, and Zsa Gabor. It is what I like to call a moment. And Paul lays everything out. He knows that Herod will understand him where Festus could not. He lays it all out in more detail and with less interruption than Festus has yet heard the story. Paul tells about his Jewish upbringing. He tells about his initial negative reaction to the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ, how he determined that he must persecute the church, how he did persecute the church, how his actions cost Christians their lives and their freedom and inflicted lots of misery upon them. He tells of his conversion on the road to Damascus, Damascus, where he met the Christ that he was persecuting. He tells how this resurrected Christ, who had been dead but now was alive, called upon him to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. He tells how this same resurrected Christ has before now delivered him out of the hands of enemies, both Gentile and Jewish. And he tells how all men may be liberated from the darkness of the world and the dominion of Satan, sanctified by grace through faith, forgiven of their sins, and be ushered into the glorious light of God Almighty. Paul lays it all out. He preaches directly to Herod Agrippa II, whom he knows has a knowledge of the prophecies of the Old Testament. And he asks Herod, he says, compare these prophecies which you already know to those things which you also already know about Jesus, because Jesus' case was not tried in some dark corner. It was a big deal in Jerusalem. And you know about it, Herod. Compare the prophecies to what you already know about Jesus and what I can help you understand more about Jesus, and see if they do not fit together like hand and glove. Ponder these things, Herod, and tell me what you think. Is Jesus or is Jesus not the final fulfillment of all the hopes of our Jewish people? And is it so incredible, if that is so, that God would resurrect the Messiah from the dead, which after all was also a matter of prophecy? Tell me, King Herod, if all this makes sense to you. There are two responses to Paul's defense. Bernice does not weigh in one way or the other. Herod, to whom Paul was primarily speaking, says, and there's a disagreement here. As Bill read, you have one thing. Do you think in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian? Like, nice try, pal. But I'm not ready to bite on what you're selling. Some versions take an alternate translation. Well, if you keep talking just a little bit more, you will persuade me to be a Christian. I don't know which school of thought is correct, whether Herod Agrippa II was trembling on the verge of conversion, or whether he was making a challenging, ironic remark. I don't know. You pick. But what a state of things if Herod the Great tried to murder Jesus Christ at his birth, and his great-grandson should tremble on the edge of belief. Whichever way you look at it, Paul answers, long time, short time, either way, I wish that not only you, but everyone in this room and everyone everywhere could come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ and be like me, except for these chains. I wouldn't wish the chains on them, but I wish they could know Jesus as I know Jesus. And then there is the other response, Festus, perhaps really comprehending Paul's story for the first time, shouts, you are out of your mind, Paul. You have spent way too much time studying, and it has made your head funny. You are crackers, bonkers, a few bricks shy of a load. It may also be that part of this is that Festus is still pretty frustrated at the thought that he has to write all this up in a report, which will be handed to the emperor with his name on it. Paul answers, I simply speak the truth with confidence. Ask King Herod where I've gone wrong and what I've said that isn't so. Festus, Herod Agrippa II, and Bernice step aside to confer for a moment. And they come to this conclusion, whatever Paul is, he is no criminal. And if he had not already appealed to Caesar, now that his case is properly understood, we could just set him free. We could take the chains off and take him to the door and say, have a good life and stay out of trouble, Paul. Not that Paul would have stayed out of trouble. But if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, now that we get what he's saying, we could just have let him go. There's the story. Again, we must draw applications, and I'll go one shy this week. Last week I had 5 applications. This week only 4, and again, most of them will be brief. One, and not new, the will of God shall be done. This case dragged on interminably for what I am sure seemed to Paul and his companions no good reason. It dragged on because one governor hoped for bribes. It dragged on because the next governor just didn't understand the case. It dragged on because of political intrigues. It dragged on because of the normal slowness of the wheels of any bureaucratic organization. It dragged on because the Roman mind just did not understand these Jewish problems. But however you look at it, the case dragged on, and the final result of the dragging on of the case is that Paul, seeing no other alternative, appeals to Rome, and now there is no possibility that he will not go to Rome. The will of God shall be done. Second, should it not be our fervent desire that all men, whatever our relationship, whatever our national or political differences, whatever our disagreements, should it not be our fervent desire that all men come to a saving knowledge of God through Jesus Christ, even the ones who hold us in jail and put chains on our wrists, and in other ways abuse us and limit our freedom? Should it not be our desire that even they should come to a saving knowledge of God through Jesus Christ? Oh, give us such a desire. Third, when the world pronounces us as followers of Jesus Christ crazy, and they will, smile and keep speaking the truth in confidence. Fourth, and I will spend more time on this one, it may often seem that all the power is in the hands of our opponents. Felix had power. Herod Agrippa II had power. Bernice had power. I imagine that on this occasion they were dressed in the trappings of power. They sat in the seat of power. Paul was in chains before them, his life seemingly completely in their hands. The three of them would make whatever decisions they made, and Paul would have to just go on accordingly. The three of them would go to bed that night, safe, warm, free. Paul would still be a prisoner. So far as we know, Paul would die still a prisoner. On the face of it, all the power seems to be on one side, and it is not Paul's side. And yet, Jesus once said to a Roman governor a couple of administrations before Festus, Jesus said to that man, "You have no power over me unless God had put it in your hands." And I will add in words what is understood in that: unless God put the power in your hands for his purposes. I would like us to think for a minute about this story of Paul in terms of the verdict of history. You know, almost everyone knows or has the opportunity to know by reading the Bible who Pontius Pilate, Antonius Felix, and Porcius Festus, and Bernice, and Drusilla, and Herod Agrippa, and a whole bunch of Herods, cartload of Herods. We have an opportunity, and most of us have some knowledge of who these people were. And when you think about it, that's a little bit strange. I mean, how many other prominent names do you know from the Roman administration of the first century? And as far as that goes, these guys, Pontius, Felix, Festus, whose names we know, were not really key players. They were kind of minor functionaries in the big Roman Empire. There were a lot more powerful Roman governors of the province, a lot of different Roman governors of the province that took in Israel, but I bet you can only name three. And that would be Pilate, and Felix, and Festus. I bet you can't name one other man, though there were many, who held that office. Why can you name these three? For that matter, I'll just ask, anybody raise their hand if you think you can name 10 Roman emperors. There were more than 10. Can you name 10? Anybody name 10? 9? 8? 7? Maybe 6? Anybody name 6? 5? I bet if I ask you to name as many as you could, the ones you would name are the ones who are associated with the Bible. And I bet that's the only reason that you know whatever small list of Roman emperors, much more important than these governors, that you know. The point is this: Pilate, Felix, Festus, and the male and female members of the house of Herod are widely known only because their lives serve as footnotes to the story of Jesus Christ. Or because they met the servants of Jesus Christ, Paul, Peter, James. If they had not been associated with Jesus, James, Peter, and Paul, you would never have heard of them. One of the emperors I bet everybody could name is Nero, right? Everybody can name Nero as a Roman emperor. At least most of us could have named Nero. The only reason you know anything particularly about Nero is because of his association with Christianity. Nero had Paul killed, which again makes it seem like Nero had all the power and Paul had none. The verdict of history is different. We know a whole lot more about Paul than we know about Nero. And we favor Paul more than Nero. We have people named after the Apostle Paul in this congregation. People still name their children after the Apostle Paul. There are buildings here in our community that are named after the Apostle Paul. There are streets here in our community that are named after the Apostle Paul, the Apostle Peter too, and some others. There are vast charitable organizations that are named after the Apostle Paul. Do you know what gets named after Nero? Bad-tempered dogs get named after Nero. Despite short-term appearances, all the power was on the side of the Apostle Paul, and it was on his side because he was on the side of Jesus Christ, and all power is given unto him. Amen. Given that, I return to my first point, and I repeat it for probably the third time in these recent weeks. The will of God shall be done. Because Jesus Christ has all power. May His will be done in us. May His will be done in this congregation. May His will be done in this community. May His will be done in you. If you would stand, we will offer a time of invitation, a time for each of us to consider the state of our life and whether or not it is lived according to the will of Jesus Christ, to make such adjustments as may be necessary.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.